the Infectious Disease Program with our host Sharon Sanders from Florida, and she has a guest on the line with her. So, Sharon, it's all yours.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone, as usual. Today we're very privileged to have Mr. Richard Stapleton. He's the Deputy Director of Web Communications and New Media with the Department of Health and Human Services for the United States. Welcome, Mr. Stapleton.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you.
Well, we might as well get right to it. Could you, you know, we have a lot of students and high school students, college students, moms, dads that listen to the show. And could you just, you know, explain to us exactly what does the Department of Health and Human Services do?
Well, as our name would imply, we are charged with human health issues, and that's fairly self-evident. And then human services, and that a big piece of that is Medicare and Medicaid. So we're a very, very large department, and we have many divisions that are, frankly, much better known than the department itself, and that would include the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, Medicare and Medicaid, as I mentioned, the National Institutes of Health, as well as a number of other smaller divisions or operating agencies.
And there's quite a few programs, too. Something like 300 programs.
Oh, easily. And I don't know if anyone has count on how many different programs we have. We touch very directly on people's lives, both in terms of, in particular, in terms of health, all the way from research into health, you know, health and nutrition, disease prevention, to information on disease treatment with the FDA, you know, protecting people on the safety of drugs and food. It is an agency that we interface and to a degree at least interact very closely with people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Very serious. So when you're developing a social media program, that's hugely important because I think something like a quarter of all federal outlays are programs that are administrated or run by HHS.
Well, yeah, that's very true. Again, because of the wide range of issues and programs that we deal with, and because of their importance, you know, an enormous amount of money is going into research on trying to find the causes of various diseases and then cures for those various diseases. So we spend a lot of money, and I like to think that we spend it very well and for a very good cause.
Mm-hmm. Your main website is hhs.gov, no?
That's correct. That's the Health and Human Services departmental website. But we then each one of our agencies also has a website, cdc.gov. NIH.gov, FDA.gov. When it comes to the web and websites, we're kind of splintered in the sense that, and this is not, in my estimation, is not a good thing. But the nature of the internet and websites, how they developed. It seems like a long time ago, but it's really not. When the internet first came around, you know, somebody in some person in each office decided, "Hey, I want my stuff on the internet." And so, all these little highly focused pages were developed and organized really based on the organization structure of the office or of the program or of the department in the case of HHS. So we ended up with HHS.gov and CDC.gov and NIH.gov and SAMHSA.gov and so on. And that's a mistake. You know, it's the way things happen and the way things develop. But my personal feeling long term, unfortunately long term, I wish it would be short term, we need to reorganize all of our content by topic instead of by the various offices and programs. We have a couple of dozen websites dealing with tobacco and the health impacts of tobacco, you know, everything from stopping chewing tobacco to, you know, don't smoke and ways to quit smoking and the impacts of smoking and so on. But when your information is scattered like that, it's very hard for people to get the full picture or get to the best information. If you do a Google search for looking for information having to do with smoking and or tobacco, depending on the words you put in the search and the order in which you put those words, you'll get to different websites. And that's just, you know, that's leaving it to chance as to whether you're going to get information that's helpful, that is meaningful to you, or if it's information that, you know, may be very important to someone else, but is useless to you. So ultimately, long-term goal is that we need to reorganize the content on the Internet so that it's in, you know, all of the content on tobacco is on a tobacco website, and all of the information on cancer is on a cancer website, if you get the idea at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll read some of your programs. You can see how diverse they would be. There's Head Start,
mm-hmm.
Preventing Child Abuse and Domestic Violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's human services part of the...
Medical preparedness for emergencies, including potential terrorism. Services for older Americans, including home-delivered meals. I mean, it's so diverse.
Oh, it's...
And I can see that if each agency developed their own website, and then you have an overall health group, which is Department of Health and Human Services, kind of oversight of all of that.
Yeah.
You do get sort of... But that's, I think, how the Internet developed.
It is. Oh, it is.
You know, nobody,
I mean, this
was
is
no
not
book for me when I started. I didn't even know what I was doing.
Yeah, it's not unique to us, but it is endemic across the Internet, and it's a major problem.
Right, because it was ballooned, really.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think anyone knew how popular it was going to become, or how widespread the information, or how people will use it the way they do.
Right, right. It's a phenomenal tool. It can be infinitely better than it is today, and there's a groundswell of discussion about the need for this, and not only the need for it, but how we might achieve it. But it's not going to happen tomorrow.
No. But I think it's great that everyone has the sites up, because you know, if you're looking for health information, you know, CDC might ring a bell for somebody. Someone else might go to HHS. And I think eventually, there's so much linking, I've noticed, between the different government sites. There's a lot of linking up and down the sidebars.
We're trying to do to help people.
Yeah, you can sort of get from one to the other, or you can look around and see, well, where else would there be this information? And so I think, that's what we do, too. So,
yes.
until you get to more of your longer-range plan. On HHS.gov today, I see you're talking about insurance companies, and sometimes you all talk about some of the interests, not just pure medical, but human health interests that the secretary has expressed, or even maybe the president, correct?
That's correct. That at the HHS.gov level, we're at the policy level. We have a broad range of information here, but we will primarily, in terms of specific health information, we link out to our various agencies for that. We're more about policy and also about process. A big key area that is on the HHS.gov website has to do with civil rights, and by that I mean medical rights, privacy rights, the HIPAA law, so on like that. So we get into the process of healthcare and human services.
Right, and that
sounds totally dull and boring, but
no, but it's all part of the process, I think. So on your front page, you have something about insurance companies, then you have the remarks by the president on earthquake in Chile, then something about the grant money for community-based drug prevention coalitions, and then an announcement by the FDA. So that would be how your site's different than maybe the CDC site, which I think is maybe more health.
The CDC site is very much in tune with various diseases, mm-hmm. so it will have disease specific information as its primary goal. At HHS.gov, it's to handle policy and then also to bring to the fore some of the cross department work that's going on and. A reaction, our response to Chile, and very recently an enormous response to the tragedy in Haiti. That will all be on our site.
Mm-hmm. I noticed most of the main pages are looks like they are translatable in Spanish. Are you adding any other languages or?
We right now are trying to get as much content available in Spanish as we can. We run, as you well know, we're responsible for running flu.gov, which is it's not only a website that cuts across not only across HHS, but it cuts across the entire federal government. So we cooperate with all of the other federal agencies to put information there. On that site, we translate certain targeted information into a fairly wide variety of languages.
Right. I was yesterday pulling some things for the site, our site. We publish in 5 languages every day. And I noticed that CDC had quite a bit of things. They had added in Haitian Creole.
Yes.
And had added quite a bit of French, which I thought was really great, too. So you could get from most of the main pages, like, you know, earthquake and...
what we do, translation is it's a huge problem for us. It's very expensive. So what we do, we have limited funds for it, so we try to target the translation. So on flu.gov, we'll translate into Vietnamese and a number of the languages that are, in particular, were areas that were of concern for the H5N1, the avian flu, was, you know, ravaging parts of Asia. But conversely, for the Haiti situation, we'll translate into French or Creole. Mm-hmm. So we try to target, make the best use of our money. And where we know that there's a non-English speaking audience that needs certain key information, we'll try to make that information available to them in a language that that they can understand.
Now, we spoke a little bit earlier today, and you had indicated that you were there working when Secretary Leavitt started his blog and did some of that initial work. You know, deciding to get on the internet with public health information. Can you talk about? I think he was the first secretary to do that.
Yes, Secretary Mike Leavitt was the first cabinet secretary to have a blog, to have a true blog. And the word blog seems to be getting muddied a little bit in terms of definition, but the secretary. Initiated a blog in which he invited people to comment, and people did, and people commented on the comments, and the secretary commented on the comments, and I think really set him apart, because this whole new area of what we call social media social to me means that there's an interaction, there's a back and forth. And so we'll put something out, send it out to people, and invite them to comment back to us. And that's an important kind of new step for government. First step, which is simply to ask the people, what do you think? But I think, and the value of the bar that Secretary Leavitt said was, here's what I think, tell me what you think. And then he listened. He read what people said, and he responded to that, whether he agreed or sometimes disagreed. So there was, it completed the circle, if you would, that there was a conversation. You know, I think this. What do you think? You think that? Well, I think that's a good idea, or I disagree with you. But it established a conversation, and it was very enlightening to people. We're, of course, now social media, we call it new media, but it's not quite so new. And it's interesting that there are more and more tools, if you would, that facilitate interaction and interface through the internet, through social media. You know, going far beyond blogging, although blog is it was one of the earliest and still, I think, one of the best for engendering real conversation. I mean, Twitter certainly has run away in popularity. It's enormous popularity and enormously useful. But it doesn't really allow for the kind of interchange, of conversation that a blog allows. But there are many tools. We're looking at quite a number of them, and we are using quite a number of different social media tools on our various websites. Blog is the true blog is not being used a lot, and in part because it takes a lot of resources. If you've got, you know, hundreds or thousands of people responding, commenting, well, somebody's going to have to read those. I mean, that's the whole point. And then to read them and respond also takes resources. So blog, a true blog where there's a two-way conversation is quite resource intensive. Everybody today wants to have a Twitter account. Everybody wants to tweet. What I try to say to people, or what I ask people, is, oh, I want to tweet, or my boss wants to have a Twitter account. I ask, and I don't do it facetiously, I ask why. You know, what? It's a communications tool. What is your message? What are you going to communicate? Because a lot of people want to have a Twitter account so that they can be cool and say, oh, I've got a Twitter account, I tweet, and they'll tweet once or twice or three times and then get bored and go away. Or they tweet and wonder why nobody follows them, and they don't follow anyone else. So there's Twitter is so new that it's not, you know, it's still really sexy, and that'll shake out too. I'm sorry, I'm just yammering on here.
No, it's great to hear the thought process, because I also asked you earlier today, we talked a little bit about the contest you had to develop a public service announcement for H1N1.
Yes.
And I said to you, well, you know, how do you come up with these ideas, and who thought of that? And you kind of made a chuckle.
Well, you know, I can't tell you who thought of it. The way we're for all the work we do, we're a really small group of people, and we got a group of really bright people who like to like to push the envelope. They like to try new things, and we're always sitting around. Well, we're not sitting around very much, but we're always talking about this climate or environment that we work in, of the internet and new media and social media and you know, public interaction, public interface, and so on. And we're always coming up with ideas and what ifs. And one of the nice things about working in the internet is that it's quick and it's initially cheap. So you can try something. And if it works, well, wonderful. And if it doesn't work, well, okay, that didn't work. Let's try something else. You move on to something else the next day, and you can put up a web page, and if it doesn't work, you take it down. And, you know, no harm done. So anyway, we had this situation at the onset of H1N1 where we really needed to get a message spread broadly about how you can prevent or slow the transmission of the flu. And we needed to get it to a new audience. And by new audience, I mean a different audience, not the people who normally pay attention to flu messages. Because H1N1, you know, the seasonal flu, the people at risk are the very, very young and the very, very old. And so the traditional messaging on seasonal flu has been to mothers of the very young, and primarily to old, you know, senior citizens, older people. Well, the H1N1 is attacking what I call prime of life people, and you know, pregnant women, young men and women, people who traditionally don't pay any attention to flu messages because it doesn't, you know, is not my concern. I'm not an old person. So we had to try to reach a new and disinterested audience. We had to do it very quickly, and we had to do it with no money. And somebody said, well, why don't we use YouTube? Why don't we have a contest? Why don't we ask people to create public service announcements? And a public service announcement, you know, it's a 30-second TV commercial or a 60-second TV commercial that's for doing something good as opposed to buying or selling something. So it's public service announcement. So, and we kind of tossed the idea around, and then we got hold of the people at YouTube, and they thought it was a good idea and wanted to play a role, again, at literally in a public service. And so we put together this contest, and we asked people to create a public service video public service announcement that would carry the message of preventing the transmission of the flu, you know, primarily wash your hands, sneeze into your elbow, so on like that. And it was wildly successful. We had, I think we got something like 250 different PSAs were submitted. We had, and the contest itself drew, you know, a lot of attention to the subject. We had a group of what I call subject matter experts, and that sounds so government-y, but anyway, it was some flu people and some people from volunteered from the broadcast media here in Washington, and this panel rated all of the entries and got it, narrowed it down to the top 10. So the 10 best public service announcements. Now, all of these are on YouTube, so anyone can see them. Then we put the top 10 up on YouTube in a contest, and here's where the YouTube people worked with us on this. We created a contest. We asked the public to vote. You know, what's your favorite public service announcement? And the number of views, the number of people that looked at these public service announcements, it was extraordinary. And in the end, there was a very clear number one, a very clear winner. I'll get to that one in a second. But in the meantime, while this contest is going on, the Cable Television Association came to us and said, this is really exciting. And, you know, we got a lot of public service time. We'd like to not only have your winner, but we'd like, you know, we'd like to look at all 10 and probably run all of them. And I happened to mention that one of the ones that didn't make the top 10, but it was in Spanish, and they just, oh my goodness, we a Spanish public service announcement. We want that. So many of these, we ended up with actually 11 public service announcements that all got airplay someplace. And then the winner was an African American doctor who is the medical director for the Long Island Railroad up here out in New York, and he did a rap song, and it was just wonderful. And the thing, I mean, it was so perfect because we reached an audience that we could never reach with a flu prevention message. And I mean, and his video was downloaded in the hundreds of thousands of times. It was just amazing. And then he was, you know, the story made, the television networks picked it up, and USA Today did a story on it. So, I mean, this little gem of an idea that started so small that I can't remember who it was grew into this thing that generated enormous public outreach of a very critical health information message. And
I,
we have fun.
I voted for him.
Did you?
Yeah. I thought it was brilliant.
You were not alone. I mean, he was just wonderful.
I did. I thought he was brilliant. He was he was funny, and he had a, you know, he did a little dance, kind of a little rhythm thing going there.
Yeah. It was, I can't imagine what you would have to spend if you went out to an agency and asked them to create something, you know. It was just a ton of fun. Now, what we have done, because, of course, that created a lot of interest in video and public service announcements and so on, we put together a fairly thorough lessons learned, how we did it and lessons learned, because we found some mistakes we had to correct along the way. And we've put that on our website so that other people can benefit from our experience. And everything we do in new media, we try to do that. We try to do a lessons learned. Here's how we did it, and here's things to avoid, and so on, and make that available to other people so that they can take advantage of what we've done.
Well, that was a hit, I think. So also, you guys have a YouTube account.
We do.
And how do you, you know, what's on that, and how do you make those decisions?
The YouTube account is... it's got some good stuff on it, and then it's got stuff on it. The good stuff that's on it is we have a lot of public service announcements, a lot of video messaging, particularly on flu. That's valuable because, you know, every time somebody looks at it, you've got another set of eyes on your health message. But we also find that if it's on YouTube, it'll get picked up. And, you know, part of the wonderful thing about YouTube is, you know, if you like something, you send it to a friend, and they send it to a friend, and it's that viral, ironically using viral messaging to fight the flu virus. But the other stuff that goes up there, we will put, we'll do on, and thinking of, because you're a flu audience here, we did a series of webinars on the flu, strictly informational, long form, you know, half hour. We did one for pregnant women, one for moms, one on flu and the AIDS population. So it's a way of reaching out. So you do the webinar, and that's a one-shot thing, but then we put it up on YouTube, and again, you reach it. You tap into the viral nature of YouTube, of sending it to a friend, someone who might be interested. So we do that. We in the height of H1N1, the CDC had weekly briefings. We put them up. And a lot of these things had a fairly limited audience, but on the other hand, we reached, you know, cumulatively, we reached a lot of people.
Well, I think it's really great. You know, also you have a new media website, correct?
Yes, we do. It's a great idea. It has great potential, and every time we try to flesh it out and do something with it, we have another crisis. You know, it got overwhelmed by the H1N1, and we had to pull all of our resources and work on H1N1. It's newmedia.hhs.gov. It has by having said that, I don't want to make people think that it's, you know, an empty page. But we have really high hopes and a lot of vision for, you know, all these people with all these wonderful ideas. A lot of those ideas have to do with newmedia.hhs.gov. So we have high hopes for all of the things we want to do. And in the meantime, you know, we've done a bunch of stuff. We put a lot of information up there. That's where we tend to put our lessons learned. We're developing a regular feature where people all across the department and across government, it's open to anyone in the federal government. It's not just for HHS, but where we'll write up a success story, how somebody successfully used new media to transmit important information.
Sure, and it's about time for us to go for a break.
All righty. Well, I thank you so much, Mr. Stapleton, for joining us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And I'm hoping maybe, you know, in the future we could ask you again to tell us what the latest is that you're all doing and get out the public health message.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back right after this with more of the Infectious Disease Program on America's Web Radio.
Concord Pharmacies have been serving the greater Atlanta area for over 25 years and has 11 locations in medical building and near hospitals to better serve you. We work closely with your physician to optimize your personal health strategy. Concord has emphasized the utmost importance of the physician-patient-pharmacist relationship. Do not assume because we are not a national chain that we are not competitive. Concord provides competitive pricing and your copay for your prescriptions is the same as at other stores. Concord Pharmacies also provide several services not found at other pharmacies. 1. We provide you with hard-to-find medications. 2. Concord prides itself in customized compounding for medications not commercially available. For more information, call 770-671-0657 or go to our website, www.concord-pharmacy.net.
Is there a cure for glaucoma? How does LASIK eye correction work? What is the difference between hard and soft lenses when it comes to contacts? If you or a close friend has any questions like these, then waste no time. You need to be listening to For Your Eyes with host Dr. Andrew Schatz. Dr. Schatz is a board-certified ophthalmologist and is here to answer your questions. So tune into Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM, and stream live at www.radiosandysprings.com every Monday from 5 to 6 p.m.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
This is out in
It's time to return to Sharon Sanders and the Infectious Disease Program. Sharon, I understand you have another guest on the line.
Yes, I do. We're very privileged to have Mr. Andrew Wilson. He's the web manager and new media strategist with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is also known as SAMHSA. Welcome, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you very much.
Could you please tell us, I guess we'll start with, can you tell us what SAMHSA does?
Sure. SAMHSA works principally around issues of mental health and substance abuse issues. So there's quite a bit of research that we do, and then obviously a lot of outreach around those particular issues.
Sure. And that follows under the sort of general HHS umbrella, no?
Exactly, yes. We're one of what is called within the sort of HHS community, one of the OPTIVs, one of the operating units, the functional operating units of HHS. But we fall under the general umbrella of Department of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm. And so your programs are... Well, your mission is to reduce substance abuse and mental illness, and you work through, the Center for Mental Health Services?
Right. There's a couple different centers that are a part of SAMHSA and sort of been traditionally sort of known as the core areas of SAMHSA. We have a new minister that's been on board, and we've really been talking a lot and focusing on some 10 strategic objectives that we have now. And everybody can obviously get them from our website. They focus on lots of different areas, but the most cross-cutting of all these being mental health and substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. And you started over at HHS working on flu.gov, or I think it was birdflu.gov. Right?
Yeah, actually, originally it was pandemicflu.gov when I first arrived there, and then during my tenure down at HHS, it transitioned from pandemicflu.gov into flu.gov.
Mm-hmm. So you were part of the very first efforts for HHS to get, you know, expand initially what Secretary Leavitt had started.
Sure.
You were part of the, I guess, expanding those websites and then getting on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so when I arrived there, it was still a relatively static site, and it was before all, you know, the recent, you know, H1N1 outbreak started. But there have been some really good, I mean, really groundbreaking work done. Even in social media, there was some really good blogger outreach and some other work they had done around pandemic preparedness. But when I got there, obviously, I was very fortunate that it coincided with a real increase in the willingness and empowerment of the government to take a bigger role in social media. And so we started on Twitter, and then we, you know, we increased our presence in Facebook, and particularly on YouTube, as the use and importance of video has continued to expand, and really looked to get out there and engage with people and talk to people, you know, where they're having these conversations, and not just rely on people coming to the website, but realize that people are talking in all sorts of other venues now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, you know, I'm a follower.
Mm-hmm.
I have your Twitter account. Tell everyone what that is.
My personal account?
Well, the Andrew Wilson.
Yeah, it's just at Andrew P. Wilson.
Right. And there it's, you know, a lot of public health, but a lot of social media sort of hints and tips and comments and...
Yeah, no, I really made a conscious effort when I first got involved on Twitter, and I will readily admit that I was one of those people that did not get it when it first came out. I mean, I heard about it, and for a while I didn't really understand the buzz, but after I had the opportunity and took some time and got in there and used it, I found it as such an invaluable tool to connect with people and establish relationships there. So for me, one of the things that I asked to do as part of some of the outreach around both the peanut recall that happened a year or so ago and then again around H1N1 was to be able to go out and interact with people, you know, using my name and face rather than just solely relying on a more traditionally branded or government account that's under a standard logo and a standard name. But by going out under Andrew P. Wilson, I felt that I could establish and maintain relationships there that would have been more difficult to do, again, under a sort of a standard approach.
Well, I think it's it makes you real.
Exactly. I mean, it's
interesting.
For me, I mean, I think there, I absolutely believe there is value in having these some of the more traditional accounts out there that are used in a lot of ways, mostly to as another channel to get information out to people. You know, as I said, it's important to recognize that the online conversations that are happening right now are not just happening, you know, on a website, but they're happening all over the place. So we need to be able to. And when I say we, I see, speaking more generally the federal government, not just around flu or SAMHSA right now, but generally to be out in these networks where people are participating and having conversations. So there is value to use those more broadcast accounts or channels to push information out. But yeah, I think it's very hard for me personally to imagine that I can establish a real meaning relationship with an account like that. I want to have somebody that can tangibly feel like I'm having a conversation with another human being.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Because at Flu Trackers, we use our globe.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, there's my picture there.
Right.
But I'm doing the Flu Trackers account, mostly because there's so many of us, there's so many contributors on the site. I didn't know really how to pick.
That,
what would I pick? I don't know, you know, that was my...
That's a great point, and I've seen some people or some organizations take a few different approaches to that, and some of these I think were a little bit newer, and the way that I've seen them do it is they might use a generic account, and then at the very end of it they use a code, like a little carrot, and then their initials at the end of the tweet to indicate, you know, who that particular person might be that's tweeting it on that particular, you know, for that particular tweet. And there's some other approaches that people use. Obviously, like Dell and some other organizations will use a person's name. They'll have multiple accounts for their organization, but they'll use the name and maybe the person's first name as another approach. But yeah, I think there's different ways to do it, and there's different ways to handle it. I would never presume to say that I know the best way or the only way. I think there's lots of different ways to do it, and it's a question of finding what works for you. And finding how you can be successful and finding how you can engage with your particular audience, I think.
So for SAMHSA, mm-hmm. so you have the Andrew Wilson, T. Wilson tweet that's yours, but heavily, you know, public health and
right.
social media oriented. And for SAMHSA, did they have a Facebook?
They didn't originally, and actually for Twitter, I still use my personal account, although I don't necessarily self-identify on my own account right now, that I do work for SAMHSA. I've actually sort of separated that to some degree, although I do, as you mentioned, I talk a lot about public health news issues that are related to what we do. But we have a specific, SAMHSA Twitter account now, which is SAMHSA, SAMHSA, gov, so SAMHSA.gov, all one word. And we also started, or I also started a Facebook page not too long ago, and that's just facebook.com/SAMHSA.
Mm-hmm. And is SAMHSA going to get a YouTube account too?
Funny you should ask. We were just talking about that today. I was talking to some of my former colleagues down at the department level about that. And I think very much that we will pretty soon. The challenges that, or one of the challenges that I see right now for federal government use of social media and participation in social media is that there's a real tendency to, since the barrier to entry to all these different channels right now is so low and almost anybody can go out and, you know, sign up for an account, that there's a tendency to get out there and just put something out without thinking real strategically about how you can use it effectively. Is it a good use of resources? Do you have the resources to really engage and provide value to your audience? So I think everything that we do, or everything that I'm involved with, at least, I really try to take a measured, sustainable approach, and just do it, you know, when it makes sense and when it's going to really add value for people.
You know, no, for us, that's exactly our same exact consideration. You know, I just got the stats out of the server for February, mm-hmm. and we were in 190 countries.
Wow.
From 190 countries, and we had 90,000-something uniques. Last month we had 120,000 uniques.
Mm-hmm.
And so the site, and we have, you know, a few hundred people that participate every day updating the latest outbreaks and public health information and studies. And that takes, that's more than, you know, 8 hours. Right?
Sure, absolutely.
And so then, but, you know, everybody has a blog, so we have sort of a prototype blog. That what we do is we take off some of the things off of the site that, you know, we think we should highlight, and they're sitting on a sort of a static blog. It's not really conversation because we have that on the discussion site.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a Twitter account, which we do update all the time.
Right.
And we have people on our site that we retweet them. They're
uh-huh.
they're on our site primarily, but they also have a Twitter account, so we retweet them.
Uh-huh.
And then we have a YouTube account that only has maybe 3 or 4 YouTube's on it, but we thought, well, we should probably reserve our name.
It's a challenge because you do want to be out there and you want to participate, and there are people that if you don't get out there and you don't get involved in these conversations, they will, you know, particularly for things that are very visible, you know, co-opt your name or co-opt your some of your identity out there, and I certainly have run across that at HHS. In some cases that's okay. I mean, if they're just taking your information and they're just getting out there because you're not doing that already, that's fine. But if the challenge is if they're out there and there can be some confusion about who the actual author is of that, or who the actual owner is of that social media property, that for me is a particular concern. And one of the things that hopefully we're going to do here really quickly at SAMHSA is get a page up that shows where our social media properties are, because not only do we have our main accounts now, but there are some other ones that are either program-specific or campaign-specific, either Twitter accounts or Facebook pages, and make sure people can go somewhere and validate all the places where we actually do have a legitimate presence, because it can be a concern. People out there, again, sort of co-opting your name or your you know, your mission or some of the things that you are known for. So it's a balancing act.
Or
change
your name by one letter.
Yeah, exactly. It can be a real challenge, and that's very relevant to the H1N1 situation. I know when that first came up, literally within, you know, a day or a couple of days, when it really became, you know, came to everybody's consciousness, and was, I mean, there was just an enormous volume of of traffic online, particularly Twitter, where news spread so rapidly, so many accounts were coming up that had H1N1 or the time swine flu in their name. And for me and for some other people, there was concern about, you know, how do we control that? How do we manage that? And ultimately, you know, my decision and the sort of approach we took that was that let's focus on providing good content and getting our name out there as being known for a reliable source of information rather than being too concerned about these other accounts, because we could spend all day, every day, just trying to get these other accounts knocked down or, you know, trying to address that issue instead of focusing on getting good information, good quality information out there.
Right, right. Well, I guess that's a compliment, though, right, when somebody...
Yeah.
Sincerest form of compliment, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are people, I mean, particularly in a crisis, there are people, unfortunately, that are out there, you know, trying to take advantage of the situation and may use that or use links to drive traffic to their site, you know, irrespective of, you know, if the site actually has something to do with the event or the issue at hand. So.
Right, right. I guess that's all part of this learning process.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a learning process every day for everybody that's involved.
It's been
so.
Up for a year almost, right? About.
Which one? The
main Twitter. It's been up for about a year now.
Yeah, it's probably been about a year. I mean, we actually started with a different Twitter account when I first got there. We had a different name. It was actually more tied back to when the site was more oriented toward bird flu or avian flu. Mm-hmm. And we started with that just because at the time that seemed to be the biggest threat that you know, a lot of people were concerned about, and that the site in particular had been really geared toward, and we wanted to have a name that was more reflective of what the, you know, what the issue was, rather than a very, you know, a formal, you know, pandemic flu.gov name. So that ended up being a little bit of a problem for us. We had to shift gears as it shifted in H1N1, and we weren't. It gave you some perspective on, you know, the importance of you know, the name and to try to maintain, you know, a tie to what the issue is that you have, but particularly in cases where that might shift to some degree, that you want to build in some inherent flexibility into that.
Right, right, exactly. We learned that ourselves. and you also have something called Andrew P. Wilson's Posterous.
Yes.
Say that.
I think it's pronounced Posterous. I'm not so sure. It's either Posterous or Posterous, and That's a really good question about how to pronounce that. But it's basically a very simple, it's a very simple blog. A lot of people like it because you can actually post from your email account. You just send an email to your blog and it posts automatically. It's a very stripped down. It's a very many fewer bells and whistles than like a WordPress blog and so forth. And that's really it's a personal space. Where I talk a lot about issues that are related to, you know, government and transparency and openness and a lot of the things that are going on in this space right now. It's not representative of my position here or anything else, but I do use it to try to engage with people and have, you know, with some broader conversations. Obviously, I mean, Twitter is great and I've made some wonderful relationships and contacts and connections via that, but sometimes if you want to have a more in-depth conversation, you really have to find other ways to do that.
Right. Right there on the front page, you have three ideas for more open government.
Sure.
And so the first one you say is that cultivating public participation and engagement online will be a long-term process.
Yes. Yeah. There was actually, it's interesting. There was a couple of posts that came out in the last few days, or maybe about a week or so ago, that were talking about the current open government initiative that's going on out there, where at least at the department level, there's a page for all the departments that talk about openness in government, and there's also the possibility for people to engage and give their ideas about, you know, how government can do a better job and really to try to solicit and engage ideas you know, from the public. And a few posts had said, "Boy, we'd like to see some more diversity out of some of these ideas. A lot of the ideas seem very similar across departments, and we'd like to see more diversity there." So, this one individual on his blog put out a call to get more ideas, and I said, "Yeah, here's a few that I'm thinking of, and I've sort of reflected on a bit. But one of them is that you know, before you even get to that point, I think we need to acknowledge that this is really a new process for everybody, and engaging here and in this way, as you mentioned a minute ago, we're all still learning every day how to do this and how to do it well. And so I'm hopeful, and again, this is my personal perspective, not, you know, on behalf of the department. I just hope that we take a look at this and say, how can we do this sustainably for the long term and not just measure successes and failures in terms of days or weeks, but really look at how can we make this new kind of engagement really productive over the long term.
Mm-hmm. So your ideas and sort of your suggestions for your own ideas are that the government needs to be responsive to the ideas that are submitted. So if if you're opening up your becoming open government and you're having the blogs and the Twitter and et cetera, that you then have to respond to some of the ideas you're getting back.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's critical, and I think this goes beyond government. I think this is sort of a general best practices. In the social media, sort of new media space now, is if you're going to go out and publicly ask for suggestions and ideas, it's incumbent upon you to be responsive to what people are saying. And that doesn't mean in every case that you're going to be able to do exactly what they suggest, because different people are going to have different perspectives, and it's certainly the case, or certainly possible, that there will be different, two people will have diametrically opposed suggestions and ideas. So it's just practically impossible to respond and react to every single suggestion or agree to everyone that is given. But at the very least, you need to acknowledge, what's being done, and how you plan on responding to those ideas. I think it would be from anybody's perspective, mine included, if somebody asked me for my advice and input, but then they just turn around. And this is the same in the offline space. It doesn't mean it's online. It's anywhere in your office. If somebody asks for your opinion, but then clearly ignores it or doesn't respond to it, that can be really discouraging.
Right. And so you also recommend that as you're developing your online relationships, develop the offline ones too, sort of what complement each other.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these conversations are great that we're having online, but I don't think we should neglect or forget about that a lot of great activity and ideas and organizations maybe only participate marginally in the online space or are just not accustomed to this yet. So how can we bring these other groups into the conversation? How can we engage them and make sure we get ideas from everybody that really has something valid to contribute?
Mm-hmm. As I see your tweets, go by, there's some, terms I just don't know, and I don't have time to learn them.
Sure.
And so I just sort of go, yeah, on to the next thing.
Yeah.
But, like, what's GovLoop?
Oh, so GovLoop is a, it's actually, it was an individual, he tweets off of GovLoop, but there's actually a person behind it. And he was formerly at Department of Homeland Security, I believe, and started using the Ning platform, which is a sort of a person. It's a platform that allows for the development of customized social networking site. So anybody can go onto Ning and sign up and create a little site for, their local garden club or their local housing homeowners association or. But it scales very easily and very quickly up to much larger. So he started a site for people in government, and often it's touted as being Facebook for government employees. But there's no sort of verification process. There's a lot of people in there that may be just not necessarily government employees, but they're interested in government, and particularly in sort of online, digital engagement and how that works. And so I think, I wouldn't want anybody to quote me, but because I'd have to check, but I think there's, over 20,000 people that are actually as part of this network now, from all over the country and from all different levels of government, whether it be county, state, federal, certainly there's a lot of people in there. And it's a really great space for people to talk about these issues again, about how do we use these tools in a responsible manner? How can we do a better job of, or how can we look at new ways of doing business because of how, what these tools offer us now that we just didn't have even a year ago or several years ago? So it's basically an online social network dedicated to government, lots of federal government, but also government at other levels as well.
What does Mashable mean?
Mashable is just it's a website. I think it's Mashable.com, and they do. They're really one of the premier sites that blogs and talks about social media and its uses and its impact and its implications for how people do business. And you know, they're really good at giving breaking news and for giving tips and ideas about what's up and coming in social networking and social media. And for me, it's important because although we can't, government is never going to be on the very leading edge of all these technologies, it's important that as we engage, at least, you know, again, my personal perspective, it's important as we engage and we use these tools to try to be as forward-thinking as possible and make sure that as we do things now, we don't put ourselves in a position that's going to make it more difficult for us to do something we'd like to do at a later date. Mm-hmm. Or if there are going to be opportunities because of new services or platforms or things that are out there, if they're going to help us do our job better, it's incumbent upon us to pay attention to that and really, you know, see what's going on.
Well, we have about 4 minutes left, and so I want to spend the rest of the time talking about if there's a student listening and they are in college and they are interested in some, you know, a public health issue on their school, maybe it's a certain thing that happens in their area. Geographically, they have a certain, maybe they have ticks, deer ticks, or mm-hmm. in a forest area.
Sure.
Or mosquitoes, maybe they're in South Florida or something. Hmm. Or they're just, you know, they're concerned about flu.
Yep.
How would somebody on that level start? What would be the first thing that they would do if they say, listen, I want to get involved in social media about this particular illness that I want to investigate and maybe even draw some people in my community?
Yeah, that's a great question because I really feel like a lot of the future of social networking, at least how it's evolving right now, is this more of a micro scale at the community level or neighborhood level or city level. And you see that in different places right now. There's blogs and there's some larger newspaper chains that actually do some, that track what they sometimes call micro blogs. So what I would really do, and this is also interesting because I've been looking at this actually from my own community's perspective and trying to engage there with almost like a different persona for myself, I would encourage people to go onto Twitter and go to search.twitter.com, which is the advanced search engine for Twitter, and you can do searches there, keyword searches just as you can in Google, but you can also do targeted searches by location. So you can search for issue X within a radius of 50 kilometers of your hometown or of this zip code or wherever you might want to target. And then see what people are, and then you could look and see what people are saying in that area. See what they're saying related to your particular interest. Start following them, and then just start following links. You're pretty quickly going to come across lots of, I think, relevant information because people, Twitter is great for sharing news and information, and they're always going to be linking to blogs and other kinds of other sources of information that are relevant to what you want to do. And at the same time, what I found, which is really interesting and I think very important, again, from this local perspective, just in my county, Howard County in Maryland, I did this search recently, and I found 10, 20, 30 very local, specific, either community or county-level organizations, whether it's a public library, whether it's Department of Transportation or whoever it might be, have Twitter accounts right now.
Sharon, I'm afraid we're running out of time.
Oh, okay. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to America's Web Radio, and we appreciate you listening. And stay tuned to America's Web Radio for Your Eyes coming up next.